Hey, 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 it's me, Katie here. Grab a notebook and a cuppa and join me in the sociology staff room. Hello, and welcome to the sociology staff room. We're here with Vicky, our GCSE sociology guru. So a different sort of face that we hear or from, normally obviously hear sometimes from Duncan in the background. And we've spoken to him a few times, but it's nice to have you on, Vicky, first of all. So thank you for coming on today. Appreciate it. Particularly, we just had a couple of audio issues on my behalf, so thank you for your patience as well. So we're going to be talking about GCSE sociology today, aren't we? So,
yeah.
And I think it's a really useful sort of conversation to be having, because I think we've got lots of staff that either come from like a GCSE background into an A level or an A level into a GCSE background. So that's why I think it's really useful, because I think sometimes our specialist is one area. But before we start, just tell us a bit about yourself for those people that haven't maybe sort of come across you before, Vicky.
So like you said, I am the GCSE sociology subject lead at Tutor to You, along with geography and history. So sociology is a little bit of my job here. But previously, before I started working for Tutor to You, I was a head of geography and sociology in a comprehensive school for quite a long time. So for about 15 years, I've taught both EDUCAS and AQA. So I know both specs quite well. And sociology was always really popular, actually, and geography. They were most popular subjects at the school I taught at, which was really good. But it did bring in quite a few issues that obviously I can chat about in our session today in terms of workload, but also in terms of the huge range of ability that you're dealing with students as well. But yeah.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because I think that's one of the differences, isn't it, between GCSE and A-level straight off, is the fact that obviously with A-levels, you've got to get certain, depending on what school you're at, you have to get certain grade either points or a certain volume of grades scored, like 9 to 4. There's sort of those restrictions, but in GCSE, there isn't that, isn't there? Any student can take the subject. And so you've got people that are maybe working at ones or even, you know, maybe not getting anything potentially, to students getting 9 and everything in between. So first of all, what are the misconceptions that may be sort of the most common ones within GCSE sociology?
So I guess the first one for me would be actually that links to what you've just said, is that GCSE sociology is a really easy subject. And there are lots of people currently sort of asking about this on the sociology Facebook pages about, you know, they do A-level, they've been asked if they maybe want to introduce it at GCSE. And one of the things that I often hear is people getting really excited because they've got this huge cohort of students who have signed up for this brand new GCSE that they've never offered before, which is excellent. It sounds really successful in theory. But in my experience, in my first year of teaching sociology, it actually turned out to be a complete and utter nightmare, because we ended up having quite a lot of students signing up, not knowing what it was. It was just shiny and new. It sounded more exciting than boring old geography and boring old history that had been around for years and years. But obviously to them, they thought, well, like, it sounds exciting. It sounds a little bit like PSHE, so probably don't really need to do very much work for it. And quite often they're actually quite horrified at how much work it actually involves. They often think it's debating the whole time, which it obviously isn't. And it is a really quite demanding subject, isn't it? Both at GCSE and A level, and it's had this misconception for years that it's a really easy subject and anyone could do it, and actually it's not. So the first year that I taught it, the results were not very good, because students had just, you know, they thought, well, I can argue my piece, I can be a bit vocal about what I think about this and this. I don't really think I've got to write very much for my my big long answers, because it's only sociology and it's easier than everything else. So I think that would be my first common misconception. So I think definitely when you're setting it up, I think it is really important at options evening and things to make students aware that there is a big workload that comes with it, and it isn't just, you know, talking about feminism and talking about poverty and being able to argue your case. It is, you know, it's a subject with, like geography and like history, it is demanding, like RE. We know we don't dismiss any of those subjects as being easy, so we shouldn't be dismissing GCSE sociology. And that's my big this bugbear with sociology and, you know, people's perceptions of it.
Yeah, so what you're saying is the recruitment of it is making sure that we sort of really make it clear that the expectation are those sort of essays, there's 4 of them obviously in each paper, isn't there? So it's making the students aware, and I suppose the people who are involved in the recruitment of the subject as well, not obviously at you know, obviously you have like different schools that have open days and stuff like that, but obviously those people that are enrolling at that stage as well. So is there anything else that you think would be a big misconception?
Yeah, I've got a big list actually.
Go for it.
So I think that one of the next ones is that the students get really confused between the theories and perspectives. So a really good example of this, and I had this all the time when I was teaching, but I also had one of the teachers in my department who thought this as well, that Weber is a Marxist, for example. So things like that, you know, that people, you've got these great big, like, you know, he's one of the founding fathers of sociology, but we've got students not really knowing what his perspective is. Students in year 10 and 11 as well, obviously quite a lot more immature than A-level students. So they often have a really stereotypical view of what feminism actually is. And what they often believe feminism to be is quite often aligned with like radical feminism, which obviously is really important to tackle. So I used to find that boys were quite vocal about this and can be quite argumentative about why there's so much coverage of feminism. And actually, quite ironically, I used to find that they would argue that it was quite sexist against males, the subject, not really understanding why feminism is actually part of the course. So that whole, it's all about hating men again, isn't it? So that can be quite frustrating, I think, and quite tedious to deal with as a teacher.
So, can I just pick you up on something? So you said that, yeah, like, how do you deal with, say, like something like challenging a member of staff? And then I understand with students, we expect students to have those, I don't know, inconsistencies in their knowledge. But what about a member of staff? How would you deal with that?
I guess if it's in your department, I think it's really important just to offer those sort of CPD and like making sure that they are, you know, they've got time to sort their knowledge out and bring it up to date. Quite often sociology at GCSE is taught by non-specialists, so it will be picked up by people in like the history department or geography department, which it certainly was in my school. So it's making sure that you know, we used to use quite a lot of our department time. You know, we'd meet as a department every couple of weeks on a Monday evening. It was a part of the regular CPD schedule at school. And half of that meeting would be sort of put over to knowledge updates for staff, as well as the sort of, you know, the admin stuff that you have to do as part of a subject anyway. And I think it's really, I mean, certainly in geography, we did it anyway, because geography is ever changing. There's always a new case study to come up with. Sociology doesn't, because we use quite old text, we might argue that perhaps it doesn't move on that much, but it obviously does. We, you know, you and I know that as a subject it is ever evolving. So I think it is really important to make sure that you give your team opportunities to increase their knowledge, and that, you know, therefore they are confident in what they're teaching, and they are confident in the content, and it's obviously being taught accurately. So I guess that's kind of a bit of a head of department role, isn't it, rather than you as a individual subject teacher.
Yeah, so definitely doing that, allowing that time over. So sorry, I stopped you midway because I just thought.
No, that's fine. I think, I always think, I know like when I've had student teachers, not for sociology because I've never had a student teacher for that, but again, for other humanities subjects, getting them to do like almost like a knowledge audit. So going through the spec themselves and making sure they can, like, you know, they can rag it like we would with students. So making sure that you do this, and that's what I've always done with student teachers. And I think it's really useful for actual subject teachers to go through, particularly if they're quite new to it, and just think about, well, I'm really confident with this and this, but I do need to look this up because I'm not quite so sure about that. And that's really cool with you know, if you're challenging kids about misconceptions, you've got to have the confidence to be able to challenge those misconceptions effectively, or they're just going to remain, aren't they?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, sorry. I'll let you continue with the list of misconceptions.
Okay. So the other one that I've got here is about, obviously, talking about life chances for various groups of people is quite a big thing in GCSE sociology, and I know it is in A-level as well. But I think it's quite difficult for students to sort of differentiate between those groups. So, for example, they often think that all of the issues are the same for all minority ethnicities, for example. They might pigeonhole people with disabilities. So somebody is registered disabled, so therefore they've all got the same issues regardless of actually what the disability that person has. And obviously that's not really helped because some of the sociology textbooks are actually a little bit outdated, and they sometimes do use slightly patronising examples. And that's certainly conversations that I've seen sort of on Twitter, on Facebook quite a lot about the representation of different groups. And, you know, that's becoming more and more important, isn't it? And I know that textbook, like publishing companies are taking on board that quite a lot more. And again, that's not just sociology, that's in lots of different subjects, isn't it? And I've also thought that obviously there's some massive sweeping generalizations applied in regard to ethnicities as well, and this has come up quite a lot in the last year, sort of again on social media. So quite often the textbooks will characterize Caribbean families as being metrifocal and quite often having absent fathers, which is a massive stereotype, isn't it? And actually not particularly accurate. They talk about families sometimes from India and Pakistan who have very traditional backgrounds and they're likely to have the woman staying at home. Well, I'm not really sure that's quite the case so much anymore. And obviously that massive one for Asian families is the whole idea around sort of the difference between arranged and forced marriage. And that was one thing that I used to spend a lot of time on picking with students who generally believed that if you were from a Pakistani family, you were going to have an arranged marriage, whether you liked it or not. And actually you would have a forced marriage in some cases. And some students had no idea what the difference was between the two. So there's lots of things I think there. And then finally, if you're sort of talking about class, obviously, we all know the generalizations around education and parental attitude, for example, like working class parents not being interested, Chinese families being pushy, which again, massive generalizations, sweeping statements, which probably don't really have any place in the classroom anymore, and stereotypical representation in those old textbooks. And I guess the other one linked to that is the idea of all students in independent schools being really wealthy and privileged, which isn't the case. So there's quite a lot there, I think.
So how do you challenge them in the classroom? Because obviously it's using the right sources and materials and evidence. But how do you allow for that? Because I suppose I've taught GCSE sociology and I know how content-based it is. It's like a mini A-level. But in some ways I found it harder than the A-level because of the sort of the ability stretch. And so you still had to cover all of that to access.
And you have to be very nuanced as well because of that ability. But obviously those students at sort of 7, 8 and 9 are going to get that when you challenge it. But the ones down at the other end might think, this is what I've seen, this is what I believe, this is what I've read. So therefore, I think it's right. I think it's like with any subject that where students are saying something, it is that whole point about saying, in the past that might have been the case, or there are some examples, but also this, just giving them other examples that challenge that. So sort of talking about maybe your own personal experience. So I came from a working class family and my mum and dad were really interested in education because they didn't have it themselves particularly, and they didn't want me. Like my mum was a cleaner, my dad just did like manual jobs all his life, and they didn't want me and my sister to. So if you're able to like bring in your own, your own experiences, obviously that's quite a good thing. But there also needs to be a balance, isn't there? Like, oh God, Miss is going on about herself again. You need to, that balance there. But I think using sort of up-to-date examples that show that that's not, their misconception isn't correct is probably the best way to go for that one.
Yeah, and I suppose it's keeping that sort of drip feeding in, isn't it? The contemporary information that's coming through as well. And sort of, I suppose the big one, like you said earlier, is about ethnic minorities and sort of just putting that as a whole group of people, ethnic minorities.
Exactly.
Whereas actually, which ethnic minorities are we talking about? Is it the same experience for all, like you mentioned? Yeah. Sorry. Yes. More misconceptions, please. Sorry.
Yeah. And because the theories and the classic texts are, they are outdated. When you're teaching them, it's obviously like, taking them with a bit of a pinch of salt and saying, this is what they thought at this time. However, we do need to be, we've got to get kids to like question them, haven't we? And, we've got to think about their validity these days. And some of those studies that we're looking at are, older than the people teaching it, aren't they? Which is, it feels a bit nuts that we're still using them, but it's part of the spec, isn't it? So,
and I suppose definitely, like you said, increasing that research all the time and sort of putting that intersectional debate in, that the experience isn't the same if you are, for example, a Pakistani working class family versus a Pakistani middle class family on. So it's that intersectional debate for argument's sake. Yeah, sorry, I was talking away and I was like, your next misconception.
I think I've got them out. I've got my list. They're out of my system.
Do you feel relax, yeah. Now you've got them all out. Yeah. No, and I think it's important, isn't it? I think for those students that are going in to do it at A level as well, it's setting those foundations. I know not all of them, but there are two reasons, isn't there, to those misconceptions. One is that you get right students for the course. And they know what they're doing. You know, they're doing it for the right reasons. And then secondly, obviously, if they go on to A level, you want those sort of accurate foundations put into place. In addition to that, you want them for a life skill, don't you? You don't want students walking around with these misconceptions in their head, even though they might not continue it into A level, because that perpetuates some of those stereotypes, which is obviously what sociology is trying to avoid.
I will add just one more there, and it's probably this. Yeah. It's not a massive one for most students, but again, because you've got students who sign up for it, who it possibly didn't really know what it was, like the idea of arguing about stuff. I mean, I have had in the past students who have got very cross about things. So, you know, you're teaching stratification, and you're talking about poverty, and I've had very overprivileged students who are getting very quite vocal and giving some quite right wing views in the lessons about what they see and why, you know, what they think about poverty and what they think about people on benefits and things. And I think it is, I think as a teacher, you do need to be aware that there is in sociology the possibility that those tricky conversations are going to come up, but you also are going to have some students who are saying stuff that perhaps you don't want to hear in the classroom, but you need to be able to deal with that effectively. That it isn't just a case of shouting them down and shutting them up. Because that can lead to all sorts of things, can't it? But I mean, it is sort of a challenge in those things, but actually you need to have to think about this a little bit more, and then perhaps taking those students to one side at the end of the lesson saying, we need to really think about how you're expressing the things that you're saying. Because I've had, you know, students in classroom being quite vocal about things, and you think, well, actually I've got other students on the other side of the room who are families that are on benefits and are really struggling with poverty and don't need to be listening to some child on the other side of the room shouting about how it's their fault and how their family is lazy. And you know, it's one of those, it's something that again doesn't come up just in sociology. It's something that I saw as a geography teacher quite a lot. Or, you know, they deserve it, that's something, you know, which is just absolute nonsense. But it's again, well, it's just a massive generalization, isn't it, about what some students have in their heads about sociology and people in society. And I think that's why sociology is so important as a subject, because it sort of challenges those stereotypical views that we see so much in the media now anyway, don't we? Like, you know, being such a polarised country now. But at the same time, you have to really think about whether it is, you know, whether it is suitable for all students because it's so demanding. Yeah, I think it can be a bit of a minefield, GCSE sociology.
Yeah, definitely. And I know for myself, I was try it and do the trickier debates, because ultimately we have to teach all the theories. Yeah. I mean, we have to, so it's not a case that we sort of teach from one perspective or another perspective. They all have to be, and I think if you teach all of them through a perspective, it takes away the personalization of it, which is for those, to protect those students. If you are going to talk about a new right, you'd go through the new right, or if you're talking about a Marxist or a feminist or liberal feminist, etc. Then it allows the students to have those debates and to think of different perspectives, but without it being an ownership on that person. So for example,
absolutely,
child A say something to child B about their life, it's through Murray or
yeah,
from a perspective, which then protects students. It sort of detaches them a little bit. Yeah. So another one is, like, obviously with sociology, you've got at GCSE now. I mean, obviously, I've taught all the different specifications GCSE sociology, and now we have got, I say now, it's been quite a long time, since 2016, but you've got the names. How do you teach for those? It's roughly six names, isn't it? I think one topic's got a few more and a few less, but approximately. How do you sort of recommend teaching for those?
Well, so this is quite interesting. And again, it links back to what you have just said. So I was thinking about something that I'd seen on the GCSE Facebook page of the day. Actually, somebody was asking advice about this, and they were talking about how the idea about students struggling with the key theories, the key perspectives and names. And somebody suggested that they thought it was a good idea to whiz through the content first, and at the end of the unit, you just add in the perspectives and the key text. And I thought, well, I don't really think I agree with this particularly, because I don't really feel it's embedding it. Is it just sort of tacking it on the end? And I think, to me, that then implies that it isn't actually as important, whereas we know that you can't teach sociology without teaching through those perspectives and those key texts. So personally, I'm not really sure why anybody would choose not to teach the concept and the theory together. And like you said, it takes away that personal emphasis. So students are not going to be feeling offended all the time because they know that what they're being told is from this perspective that is now quite outdated. So like you say, you're talking about Murray, and obviously what he's talking about when he's talking about families probably applies to maybe a quarter or a third of the kids that are in front of you. So I don't really see how you can teach it without making specific reference to this is what so-and-so said at the time. It might not be correct, but this is a view that he had and why. And that's really important. So again, I think, like, you know, if you were going to have a lesson all about labelling in education and a few weeks later add on the work of, like, you know, Howard Becker and self-fulfilling prophecy, or Stephen Ball and the idea of, like, going and watching, like, observing kids in sets and, like, the effects of streaming, I don't think it works. I think you need to teach them together. In terms of, like, embedding them and making sure that they stand out, I mean, I've always suggested that students highlight key perspectives in their notes, or they might use a different colour just to write it. So, you know, you've got your family lesson about gender roles, for example, and then halfway through the lesson you might have a box in your book which is specifically about Wilmot and Murray and their conjugal roles and the idea of the symmetrical family, just so it stands out, but you know it's part of that actual lesson, is part of that concept, but the theory is just kind of glowing a little bit in their book just to make it stand out a bit. I think that's probably
a good embedding way of it as you go along. What about the method, the actual, because obviously you talked about the actual sort of the theorists and what they say.
Yeah.
So like you said, like how Becker and say labelling or Ball and setting. How about the methodology element? Because obviously that's a format sort of for, like, it's such a long time. It's been a year and a half since I've taught GCSE. It's weird how your brain works and sort of empties any knowledge you're not currently listening to. But say, like, also the methodology. So how would you go about teaching that? Because obviously you've got what the names is, but also you've got their methodology as well.
So some in a similar way, and again, this is sort of, I'm thinking about a conversation again I saw on the GCSE Facebook again page probably about 2 weeks ago, when somebody has said, I've just finished teaching all of research methods, I'm now thinking, shall I move on to family or shall I do this subject instead? And I know certainly I've come across, I know departments where they just start off the course doing methods and nothing else, and I think that's quite tricky, because the whole point about methods in the exam is that they are methods in context questions, aren't they? They're not just methods by themselves. It isn't just saying to you, oh, what's the, you know, list, give two examples of two advantages of questionnaires. It will always have some, you know, a type of a study, or it will have a topic that you're studying. So there's all that question's always going to be in context. So personally, I would always teach research methods as you're going along. I wouldn't teach it separately. Now, I know when I taught the Educast spec, it was sort of tacked on separately, but it wasn't when the questions for Educast weren't linked to studies, or they weren't linked to topics. They were, you know, just, it would be like a 12-month essay about the validity of questionnaires. Whereas obviously the AQA spec, it is always in context. So I think it's really important to make sure that you are doing that. So I think if you do RM separately anyway, particularly if you do it right at the start, I think the massive risk here is that you put students off, because actually we all know that methods in context isn't particularly engaging compared to a lot of the other content. So I think a lot of teachers just get it out of the way because they, you know, they perhaps feel that. But I think if you're starting a new GCSE and you've had 2 months of methods and nothing else, I think that's quite hard work. And I then think it's much harder to embed those four marker methods questions if you are teaching it that way. And they take up a massive amount of the paper, don't they? There's loads of them in that paper. So I think if you're teaching them separately, it's more difficult. So what I would do is make sure you are teaching them within the other unit. So when you do a study, you know, if you're talking about those theories and embedding those, then practice a four marker question on a regular basis, perhaps every couple of weeks. Just get students, you know, fully aware of what methods in context means, because I think students often don't realise what that means. I think they do often think that in the exam they are just going to see a question where it says give some examples and disadvantages, give some advantages and disadvantages of using participant observation, and that's it. And obviously those questions don't come up, do they? We know come up with a scenario. So I think it's really important that you teach them in that way.
Yeah, so constantly embedding it, trickle. Yeah. I think that's true for, again, a skill moving on to the A level. Just I'm conscious of your time, and I just sort of quickly ask a question, because obviously those essays are a big percentage as well of the paper. I think that's why I think, in some ways, I do think it's more challenging in a different way to the A level.
Yeah.
How do we go about embedding it? Because obviously, again, that's sort of the level of different degrees of students. I mean, what would you say is a tip? Because obviously, it's really those pill paragraphs straight off. It isn't like, I think some of them think it's going to be like RS, where they do a for and against and that's it.
Yeah.
Which I think...
Well, to be fair, I do think that the... on the AQA spec, I think that they're quite easy to prepare for, because they're always discuss questions and they're asking about how far certain perspectives agree on a certain topic, aren't they? So I think that they are quite easy to prep for, whereas the Educast spec, they're very different. You've got some 8 markers, you've got 9 markers, you've got some 12 markers which are research methods, and then you've got 15 markers. So I think that's a bit more tricky, but again, what I did the first couple of years, you know, our extended writing results in the exams were quite poor, so we spent quite a lot of time, and I've done the same actually for geography as well, just making sure that they are a regular fixture of your lessons, or they're a regular fixture of homework. So I would say doing a 12 marker, for example, at least every 4 weeks is good practice, and either doing it in a lesson context, so you give them maybe 15, 20 minutes at the end of a lesson to answer one, or just setting for homework. I mean, it's quite an easy homework, isn't it? But I guess the risk with a homework is, depending on the sort of the culture of your school and what students are like, whether they actually do it or not. But I guess you might then
ask... marking load as well, because obviously...
Well, that's tricky, isn't it? Because most people that are teaching GCSE sociology, if you're a specialist, you've actually probably got a entirely GCSE and A-level timetable, haven't you? I know certainly, I mean, I didn't work in a school with A-level, but I did work in, you know, we were an 11-16 school. But because I was teaching two subjects and I was a head of subject for both of them, my timetable was, I think I had one year 9 lesson and the rest of it was all year 11 and year 10. So it is quite difficult to manage it, isn't it? Because but you know, that it's a humanities subject or a social sciences subject, always come with huge amounts of marking, and you can't really get away with that. You can't get around the fact that they're not going to come with marking. And I know we sort of talk about the temptation of giving students a mark scheme to self-mark or peer mark, which is fine, because obviously it gets them familiar with the mark scheme, it gets them sort of, you know, practicing what they've got to write. But I personally don't think I'd then rely on this marking to inform my future planning and make sure, you know, I don't think, because a child said, oh, I've got 9 out of 12 for this, I then go, oh, brilliant, they've nailed this, I don't need to worry about them anymore. I think I'd want to look at those answers too, so I could see where those misconceptions are, because, you know, it's all very well giving kids those mark schemes, but they're really difficult for teachers to follow, aren't they? So I'm not really sure how we expect students to really master a mark scheme. So again, I think it's about just, planning and timetabling in your head or on a piece of paper when you're going to set questions. And if you teach at A-level as well, maybe like, you know, middle of the month, you set a full marker for, you set your essay questions for GCSE, end of the month, you do them for A-level. So you haven't got, you know, 6 classes of 30 kids all handing in essays to you at the same time.
Yeah, it's just sort of making sure it's rotated, because obviously you potentially could have 4 classes. I was thinking, if you've got 10, 11, 12 and 14, where's the 14 come from? 10, 11, 12 and 13, then ultimately it's making sure that you're not doing, I don't know, 50, 60, 70.
Yeah, I mean, it's not, I mean, I certainly, at my last year, when I was last in the classroom a couple of years ago, I had 5 GCSE sociology classes and 4 GCSE geography classes, and they'd all got up sort of, you know, 27, 28 plus kids in, and it was really difficult. It's just making sure that you, like, yeah, that you get planned, you get really focused on when you're going to do stuff, and then, yeah, you don't just leave it all to the last minute.
Yeah, you know, that was a lot of planning. And I suppose as kids go on, because I think, just thinking back, and then same with when you get the year 12s, I mean, it's different cohorts, but I found that maybe sort of the whole essay writing starts at the beginning when they're developing those literacy skills and understanding. And then towards the end of year 12, hopefully, should we just be planning essays? So it's about content. And then maybe we'll visit sort of in time conditions in assessment and stuff like that. So it's a whole year of writing essays, and
I think
those skills should be in place.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because I think you've got, you know, I've done both really, where I've left a lot of the essay writing to year 11.
Mm.
But to be fair, I think actually it's quite important to bring it in year 10, because particularly if you're, you know, most schools now do a year 10 mock, don't they? At the end of the year, they're sitting a whole, those kids are sitting a whole paper. So it's quite tricky for them to go into that paper without practicing those skills. So I think, yeah, in the past, probably quite a few years ago, I think I did just leave those longer answer questions for perhaps sort of maybe November onwards in year 10, in year 11 to focus on. But it is now something that I would do from the really from the outset, probably like, you know, a few weeks in. But I would say probably from October in year 10, I would be setting those longer answer questions.
Yeah.
I think it's also really important to get like kids to realise from a really early on part of that course just how demanding it actually is, and that they do step up, and it's, you know.
And I suppose for those weaker students, or the students find essay writing a bit more challenging, it's that scaffolding that goes into
place.
Definitely. I mean, and obviously, you know, it's all about adaptive teaching now, but sort of putting that into place for all students. And then it's there as a model, if you think about the work of Rosenshine and stuff like that, and there's obviously using the work of the teacher, the work of other students, and working upwards. So there's lots of sort of strategies out there. I think what you said right at the beginning is so true, isn't it? That it's the biggest misconception is it's just going to be a bit like PSHE. There's nothing, and I think they just think it's going to be a debate and that's it. And then when they see the essays and they see the four markers and how much has to go into it, that sort of exam, I think that sort of makes students think, oh, actually, it's not what I thought it was going to be. But by that point, we're already in January.
But I think that's, you know, I think it's what, well, it's the same for loads of subjects, isn't it? Loads of students take business studies at GCSE because they think it's going to lead them into a really illustrious, very well-paid career, and they don't realise actually it's a normal subject which is quite demanding. And you know, you've got students who think that if they do philosophy, they're just going to sit around like philosophizing and thinking about things, and then they get a bit of shock when they, you know, it's geography, they're not, they expect to learn about countries and learn the flags, which obviously we don't do.
I think I thought when I did science I was just going to do experiments all the time. Use a Bunsen burner.
I think I guess the slight difference for sociology is actually those misconceptions for sociology can be pretty offensive, and you know, it's a subject where if you're not careful, some quite horrible views can come out quite easily. And it's, you know, trying to minimize that, isn't it? And but you know, remembering that student, there is a, you know, we should allow students the chance to talk about things, but you've got that careful balance, isn't it, about making sure they're not being offensive, and they're not, there are then students, other students in your classroom who feel that they're almost at risk in that classroom because it's a subject where we're talking about stuff that they're living as students. And, you know, we don't want them uncomfortable in our classroom, do we? And sometimes, you know, that can be quite tricky. And I know as a teacher, I sometimes find it quite tricky to teach topics about, you know, if you're talking about ethnicities and I'm talking about it from the standpoint of a, you know, an educated white woman who hasn't faced any, you know, massive challenges in life, and you're talking about, you know, it may be issues and life chances of students who come from minority backgrounds, and then you've got students within, you know, who are from minority backgrounds in front of you. It's quite tricky, isn't it? But that's probably a discussion for an entirely different podcast.
Oh, definitely. I think we had someone. It's aware of our own different privileges, isn't it? I suppose that's the key. I know we've had some great speakers talk about this before. One I can think of off the top of my head was Azriah Harvey, who spoke about it. So it's, if anyone's interested, they can go back to some of the podcasts that we've had before about that. But yes, I think it's worth getting you back on again to talk about GCSE sociology, because I feel like a lot of stuff we talk about is maybe A-level focused. But I think it's really important to talk about GCSE, just because I think maybe I'm wrong in thinking this, but a lot of people have A-level, have really good A-level classes, think, oh, do you know, it'd be really good to bring it in at GCSE and grow the subject. but with that sort of growth, was it Spider-Man? With great power comes great responsibility.
Yeah.
So it's great to have that sort of breadth of people taking sociology, but it's not just as simple as just lots of students going on the course. Like you said, it's a very sensitive subject and requires a lot of structure and planning in place as well.
Yeah.
So not to deter people from to put that subject on as an offer, but obviously it's a bit, maybe a bit more complex at that age as well, because
yeah.
they are only year 10, and some of the stuff we deal, particularly in the family unit, they may have not even thought about or explored really,
yeah.
or maybe going through those things like you said already, but yet not privy to the full bit of information around it. So yes, excellent. Oh, thank you ever so much for your time. I really, really
You're
appreciate
welcome.
It. And yeah, so insightful. Have you got any revision blasts? I mean, just so we can do a little.
So we haven't got any live ones this year, but we have got on YouTube, there's a playlist of all of our revision blasts from last year. So we've got another, the ones that you and I presented on a couple of years back are still there. The ones that I present with Sarah last year are still there. So we've got probably on YouTube about sort of 30 odd that they can look at. But we've also got focus revision blasts for every single subtopic. And if teachers want to download them from our from Tutor2U website, they can actually download the PowerPoint rather than watch the video, and obviously they can then use the interactive activities in their own revision lessons without me yapping on all the way through.
Oh, amazing. I thought it might be worth sort of directing people, particularly yeah. this coming up with the year as well. But thank you ever so much for your time, and enjoy
You're
the
welcome.
Rest of the day. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
The Sociology Staff Room is brought to you by Tutor2U Sociology. Find us at tutor2u.net/sociology or follow us on Twitter at tutor2usoc or Instagram at tutor2usoc. You can also join our very lively Facebook groups for sociology teachers. See you soon.